Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, how much are Pennsylvania's state senators spending on expenses? The answer is now available online. Also, the Fringe Festival is back and much of it is live. But to start, the city of Philadelphia is still accepting applications from community groups seeking grant money to help quell the heartbreaking surge in gun violence. There have been 372 homicides in 2021 as of Sunday, an increase of 16% over September of last year. And over two dozen of the dead are children, many caught in the crossfire, like 7-year-old Zamar Jones, who was shot while playing on his front porch, and 15-year-old Simone Monet Rogers, gunned down during a basketball game with her brother in the Tioga neighborhood. The grant program will allocate a total of $22 million to community organizations with an eye toward investing in Philly's most vulnerable people and neighborhoods. Here with us now in studio to bring us up to date on Philadelphia's anti-gun violence efforts are Erica Atwood, Senior Director of the Office of Policy and Strategic Initiatives for Criminal Justice and Public Safety. Welcome, Erica.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone.
And Philadelphia City Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, Chair of the Council's Gun Violence Committee. Good to have you with us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Kenyatta, to you first, how can groups based in the community help to relieve the gun violence crisis?
Well, first and foremost, we have to make sure that when it comes to addressing the senseless gun violence taking place here in the city of Philadelphia, that we're taking a comprehensive approach. And one of the key areas that we know that has a significant impact in addressing the issue is supporting what we call boots on the ground organizations. These are the organizations that work day in and day out with individuals who are directly impacted by the senseless gun violence, making sure that the mothers and fathers and the children are receiving the type of support that they may need, addressing the issue of trauma support, and making sure that, most importantly, our young people have opportunities to get involved in things that are positive as opposed to things that are negative. And 9 times out of 10, it's those organizations that have that direct contact with those individuals who are picking up guns in the first place and those who are severely impacted.
Erica, I understand you have about, 90 submissions so far?
So far, yes.
What are you looking for in the applicants?
So what I'm looking for are organizations who have a history with working with communities that are most vulnerable to gun violence. I'm looking for organizations and programs that understand culturally what is happening in our neighborhoods, who can support the work of building and developing safe and healthy communities. It's one thing to remove a negative, a malignancy. What are the things that we're pouring in a positive way in our community that are supporting not only the young people who are vulnerable to gun violence, but their families and the community writ large?
Doubtless there are established community groups with a track record of success who are applying. Are you also considering some which might be innovative but unproven?
Absolutely. I think that when we talk about equity and we talk about how we traditionally, organizations are funded not just by city, but by kind of the philanthropic sector as a whole. We often don't look or value community built in the same way we value evidence-based. And what that does is create some strong racial disparities that exist in terms of funding organizations that have the trust and the understanding of neighborhoods and communities that are experiencing gun violence. And that is something that we want to set an example for with this granting program. And in partnership with Councilmember Johnson and other council members in my office and the managing director's office, we've been able to kind of upend some of the systemic inequities in funding as it relates to Black and brown organizations in Black and brown neighborhoods serving Black and brown individuals.
Councilman Johnson, overwhelmingly, shooters are young adults or teens. And male, what do we know about, at this moment in time, what is happening in their lives that drives them to pick up guns and open fire?
Well, we have to recognize that, first and foremost, where we see a lack of investment primarily in opportunities for our young people, which are predominantly in poor neighborhoods that are Black and brown neighborhoods here in the city of Philadelphia, you see a rise in gun violence. And so we have to really make sure that we're investing in either opportunities or resources to support our young people. Now, one of the key areas that I have been paying attention to is just making sure that we're monitoring how young people utilize social media.
Yes.
We know hurt people from doing the research and being on the ground addressing this issue. A lot of the conflicts that arise where shootings does take place are from social media and neighborhood beefs. And so playing a more critical role around conflict resolution, anger management, anti-street education with our young people, but also as a community, everyone rolling up their sleeves and figuring out, what can I do to support our young people to make positive choices so they don't live a life of crime and gun violence? And that takes mentoring, that takes after-school programming, but most importantly, is showing young people there's another way to live as opposed to the negative things that you're seeing take place inside your neighborhood. And that takes a lot of work. I try to tell people that, yes, we have made a significant and historical investment when it comes to violence prevention. We're doing the $22 million for community-based organizations, but overall, comprehensively in City Council, we passed a budget of $155 million to address a variety of different other city-related agencies that can support our young people. And the key that's, I believe, that's going to take us out of this issue of gun violence that we're seeing day in and day out is consistently us working together to support our young people, to let them understand that there are opportunities for you to follow your dreams as opposed to you getting involved in the life of gun violence.
Trauma-informed healing, mentorship, job training can all take time to have effect. You know, shootings, of course, are happening every day.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
What emergency actions must happen and are happening at the same time to stem the bleeding, bluntly?
Yes. Well, first and foremost, you know, I'm an advocate of making sure that those who are carrying guns, right, and those who are wreaking havoc in our community, they have to be held accountable. I'm born and raised in South Philadelphia, and I recognize that at the end of the day, there has to be a healthy balance. So that's one key aspect. But also, people fail to realize that during this last year, we have a pandemic. And so all the traditional ways of how we would actually address the issue of gun violence, we really haven't had an opportunity to do because social distancing and not us having that one-on-one interaction. And I'll just give you an example. When you talk about supporting our young people who are on probation and parole, normally it will be a face-to-face interaction. And that face-to-face interaction is not just about being punitive. It's a monitoring of that individual who's on probation and parole just to make sure that all the support that they may need, right, that they can receive that support. Well, that's somewhat limited right now only because of the pandemic. So that's something we have to pay attention to as we come out of the pandemic, but also try to strategically find ways to be supportive of our young people. But also, even though we are seeing significant gun violence, separate from holding individuals accountable, still making sure we're aggressive and putting those resource opportunities in front of them. I try to tell people, I say, listen, yeah, we're doing the funding, but I don't expect the funding to solve gun violence overnight. Because the reality is, it didn't get here overnight.
Right.
It has been years and years of systematic disinvestment of particularly black and brown neighborhoods. And so the funding is just a step in the right direction. But the reality is, we had a $5 billion budget. So this is like the beginning of a new way in how we're going to approach and make this a priority. But it has to be for the long term.
Erica Atwood, a tall order for some of the community groups who are asking to take part?
I don't think it's a tall order. Folks have already committed to this purpose and to this drive. What we're doing is finally recognizing the investments they've been making in community and actually putting some resources towards it in a way that shows that we value what they do and we value the supports that they give to our communities and our families.
I want to take a point that Councilman Johnson made just a moment ago, Erica, you know, that social media is exacerbating many of the beefs that end in shots fired. Are you asking some of the applicants specifically to provide guidance on navigating social media since it's such a part of young people's lives?
Not necessarily. What we are asking for in the funding priorities are kind of mentoring, safe haven, trauma-informed practices, and restorative justice. What we do understand is those of us who work with young people, we understand the impact that social media has and how it's ingrained into their culture. And so what we're doing is we're looking for kind of how are you working with young people who are at the highest risk, and how are we breaking down that vulnerability that is age appropriate, because our risk ages are kind of broad, and so it's from 16 to 34. And so you've got to break that kind of in the middle at about 24, 25 when the brain is done developing and then move up. And so we're looking for certain things that folks are doing in terms of safe havens and mentoring for younger folks as well as older folks. And so I still depend at 46 years old. I still depend on my mentors. And so that we can't we can't negate that mentorship is something that is lifelong. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at. We're looking at trauma-informed practices, because if we can figure out what your triggers are and intervene now, that might change what happens tomorrow. And so I think that some of what we looked at in terms of our funding priorities, what we know are folks who are vulnerable to gun violence need, we are paying attention to that and what are the things that we can cut off at the pass in the immediate and still build and toil the soil and actually kind of sow what are some amazing benefits in the future as well.
Who is providing oversight, Erica, in the grant process, and what are the metrics for success?
So we are, the oversight is a combination of some city officials, some community members, and some council members that will be kind of overseeing not only the process by which we're giving out applications, but actually kind of how the process is working. We are investing not just in community organizations, but we're investing in evaluation and supporting with technical assistance with the organizations. And so we will be able to build their capacity so they will be able to tell their story about what they're doing works. And that is an investment we are making, because we understand that if you're doing the work, you don't always have the time to kind of count the beans. And so we are supporting, we as a city are supporting that effort. We also have kind of an administrative group that will be helping us, making sure we stay on top of everything. And what we're looking for in terms of metrics of success is how are folks continuing to engage in positive programming? How are we reducing truancy rates in older youth? How are we making sure that they're engaged in programs that continue their education and training and economic mobility? How are we making sure that that there is attendance in the programs? Because just seeing folks oftentimes is what they need. You don't need them to figure out some great problem or solve some big idea. I just need you to show up. And that's a measure for success.
We have about a half minute. Kenyatta Johnson, you're quoted as saying in regards to gun violence, the same sense of urgency that we use to address this COVID-19 pandemic, we have to take that same approach. How do we keep that sense of urgency when it comes to shootings? What's at stake?
As my mentor, Hardy Williams, would say, staying on the case day in and day out. You know, people always ask me, how come you're doing Peace Not Guns call to actions all throughout the second councilmanic district? How come you're doing rallies? And the reason why is because we should never live in a city where a life is taken and we go about our business as if nothing has ever happened. And so we just have to stay on the case. But most importantly, work together, all city agencies working in partnership with the community, but making sure that we continuously sound the alarm that this is a state of emergency that we're in.
Okay. And Erica, quickly, the deadline is fast approaching to apply.
September 19th. So this Friday at 11:59 p.m., please get your applications in.
Okay. Erica Atwood, Senior Director for the Office of Policy and Strategic Initiatives for Criminal Justice and Public Safety. Thank you so much for joining us. And Philadelphia City Council Member Kenyatta Johnson. Great to have you with
us. Thank you.
Okay, up next on the regional roundup, we talk about the Pennsylvania State Senate, which is taking a step, a big step, toward financial transparency. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Pennsylvanians are now able to go online to see how their state senators are spending money funded by taxpayers on expenses, including district offices, travel, food, and housing. Senate President Pro Tem Jake Corman announced the decision shortly after Spotlight PA and the caucus wrapped up a year-long investigation into internal expenses for the entire legislature called the Hidden Tab, and determined the amount spent from 2017 to 2020 totaled $203 million. The Senate's move to post expenses online is a big and groundbreaking win for constituents, although there are gaps in the information provided, and the State House has yet to follow suit. Angela Columbus has been working on the investigation for Spotlight PA, and she joins us once again on the Regional Roundup. Hi, Angela.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure, and Sam Janish is an investigative reporter for the caucus. Good to have you with us, Sam. Do we have Sam
good
with
morning.
Us?
Thank you.
Oh, there you are. Good morning to you, too.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
We're going to get to the decision by Senate President Pro Tem Jay Corman to post expenses in just a moment. But first, that $203 million figure just sounds really huge. Angela, as a reporter, what was your reaction to it?
It was definitely a surprise. And I guess I should also say that $203 million from 2017 through 2020 was just to feed and house and transport and pay for rental offices and other perks for lawmakers and their staff. So it didn't include things like their salaries, legislative salaries, which are among the highest in the nation, and Pennsylvania is the largest full-time legislature in all of America. So that $203 million was just for the expenses to get them to and from the Capitol. And when they are in the Capitol or attending a legislative hearing outside of their district, to be able to get a meal or sleep. So that figure definitely was eye-popping for me. And as we began to drill down on that figure, it became even more of a shock, because we began learning that, you know, a really big portion of it was actually used to cover expenses for which no receipts are required.
Sam, what are your thoughts on that, the figure?
Yeah, like Angela said, when you get down to the details, some of them individually are pretty eye-popping as well. You know, $6.5 million for mileage, more than $1 million for meals and other food, and $4 million just to stay in Harrisburg on voting sessions, $20 million for lawyers that are not part of the staff at the Capitol anyway. So when you look at all these things, and there are thousands and thousands of records, our database at the end of the day, it included over 400,000 individual expenses, which are a lot for any constituents to go through. But when you look at them, there's some things you might want to ask about.
Yeah. So after this year-long investigation by Spotlight PA and the caucus called the Hidden Tab, the Senate is now posting information online. What exactly will a taxpayer find online when researching a state senator's expenses? What sorts of information will they see, Angela?
Well, to begin with, the information will begin in July of this year, okay. And it will be prospective going forward. So anything that happened before this summer is subject to the same type of public records requests for paper documents that we had to go through when we were compiling information on expenses. But it is definitely a significant move, because it does show by legislator or by senator, I should say, how much each senator has spent in that previous month for, you know, so there will be things like what their district office rent has been, whether they received what are called per diems, which are these flat rate reimbursements for meals and overnight lodging. It will have mileage in there, legal costs, and so forth. But even though it is a really significant step to put those expenses online, there are some limitations. The biggest one for anybody trying to do a meaningful analysis of it is really it's in a PDF form that's very difficult to work with if you're trying to search and sort and total. So I think those are the types of things that the Senate could improve on if it really wants to make these types of records publicly accessible and meaningful.
Sam, so overall, how would you characterize the decision to post information and the way the information is posted? Is this overall a win for the taxpayer?
I think it's certainly a win, considering we've had the Right to Know law for more than a decade now, and this information has been assumed to be public records for all that time, and anyone could have requested it. But, you know, in our age now, with technology being so easy, it's finally caught up to the point where they are posting this voluntarily. And then the drawbacks, I think you have to mention, as Angela said, are still that they're not posting every record. So another piece, just the fact that you can't add everything up is one thing, but people should also know that this isn't every record for every expense that is listed. So if someone sees an expense for a piece of furniture or a contract for some software, they can still request the receipts or what they call vouchers, which might have some more information on them. And that could still take anywhere from 5 to 30 days and could still have redactions and maybe even require a legal fight, which we had to do for some of these records in the last couple of years.
And let's talk about per diem claims. As you report, some lawmakers racked up expenses over the 4-year time period that topped $200,000. I think I've got that number correct. Much of it essentially untraceable. How does the per diem system work, Sam?
It works. So lawmakers can voluntarily opt into this if they like, and a lot of them don't anymore. But the ones that do, they can say that they're staying in Harrisburg for either a session day or even a non-session day when they have a committee meeting or any kind of meeting, actually. And they can say they collect a specific flat rate fee, no matter how much their hotel costs or their food costs. And they don't need to turn in any receipts for the hotel or the food to actually back up the fact that they got that per diem. So some people do this sparingly. Some people do this every day that they're in Harrisburg, and it comes up to thousands of dollars a month. And some still opt for just the receipt option, which is, like anybody else would likely do in their own job, which is hand over receipts and get reimbursed for that specific expense.
So, Angela, still the potential for some big omissions.
Oh, absolutely. So if a legislator comes to Harrisburg, it is well known, anybody who works in the Capitol knows that oftentimes either meals are sometimes provided by the legislature itself for lawmakers, or there are always lobbyists and other special interest groups who are around who will take a legislator out to lunch or dinner. Sometimes there are campaign fundraisers where meals are provided. So a legislator could, in theory, get all three meals for free in Harrisburg and yet still claim that per diem without any accountability and without having anybody know that they didn't actually spend the money that they were allotted for food. And the same goes for lodging as well.
And Sam Janish, because lawmakers wrote the rules around reimbursements, I'm guessing the rules could be pretty tough to change.
Yeah, it's a good point. And these, it's not just recently that they've had some scrutiny over this. Going back 15 years to some other financial issues at the Capitol, per diem specifically have been raised as a point of potential abuse. And, in that time, lots of reporters have done lots of stories about these, and, it hasn't risen to the level of change. But there have been some lawmakers who have told us and who have actually said that they would hold some hearings potentially on per diems and other types of reimbursements. So we're still waiting to see if those will come through.
Okay. So in the Hidden Tab investigation, you also found some pretty big spenders. Angela, over in the House, State Representative Chris Senato, what is his story?
So he is a longtime legislator from Western Pennsylvania. His claim to fame as a legislator, really, and it is a point of pride for him, is that he never misses a day of work and that he is ever present at various committee hearings that may not be in the Capitol and that may not be during the legislature's actual voting session days, but maybe, for instance, when over the summer where they're on break. And his claim to fame is that he attends all of these things. The argument that he makes is that it makes him a better legislator, it makes him more attuned to issues, but it also costs millions upon millions of dollars. And that was actually one of the stories that we wrote about. This specific legislator, Representative Sinato, spent $1.8 million in mileage, meals, lodging, travel, and other, you know, office-related costs over that four-year period from 2017 to 2020 that we looked at.
And again, all charged to taxpayers.
Yes, all covered by taxpayers. And again, a good portion of that was per diems, which do not require receipts.
What was his reaction to that nearly $2 million tab when you pointed it out to him?
I think his words were, "I can't believe that, and I don't know where you're getting it." But, you know, he did come back and say that, again, in his defense, he said that it's very important for him to be present at these meetings as a longtime legislator, and that in the long run, it makes him a better public official.
Sinato is a Democrat. Sam, Democrats and Republicans are equal offenders when it comes to high expenses?
Yeah, I think it's very mixed, and it depends, you know, a lot on location. Like Representative Sinato is at the furthest, he's, you know, as one of the furthest districts away from Harrisburg, and a lot of other ones from, you know, for example, Erie, you know, more than 300 miles away from Harrisburg, you know, naturally collect more in mileage.
Sure.
And there's some things that, you know, some of them might use a state-owned vehicle instead and lease that for a little bit less than they would collect in mileage. But it really depends on where you are. You know, one of the people we point out in one of our stories is Senator Pat Brown, and longtime Republican appropriations chairman in the Lehigh Valley area. And he comes up more on per diems because he's in Harrisburg more.
Yeah. So let's talk about other some other perks that state lawmakers are privy to, Angela, such as, you know, gifts from lobbyists or dinners. Do these require reporting?
Well, in theory, yes. Every public official has to file statements of financial interests once a year, and that is usually in the first week of May, in which they have to report gifts over $250, and they also have to report any transportation, lobbying, lodging, or other sort of expense over $650. And when you go through these reports every year, you often see that, you know, a legislator will go to a conference, and that conference organizer, for instance, will cover the cost of airplane tickets. So those are the types of things that you normally see on it. What you don't see are kind of the smaller, quote unquote, items that may be like a dinner that may fall under the threshold of $250, but is still a nice pricey steak dinner that a legislator might have had with a lobbyist, and other gifts that may come their way, sporting tickets, tickets to galas and such. So it is not a perfect system, and there has been a very big push over the years for a gift ban in Harrisburg, but again, that really comes down to an issue of political will and having the very people who benefit from the rules currently having to make the very difficult decision to change them.
Yeah. What is the danger inherent in not having an outright gift ban, Angela?
I think people have a right to know who is trying to influence their public official, because it provides insight into why perhaps a public official may be taking a specific position on a matter of importance to them. And at the very least, there should be, if not a gift ban, perhaps more transparency on what those gifts are. Sure. And on the opposite side, more transparency on the lobbying end and what lobbyists are actually spending on specific legislators on specific issues.
Sam Janish, in some of the published articles, you spoke with Russell Eshleman, hopefully I'm getting his name right there, who heads the Department of Journalism at Penn State. He served as a Capitol Bureau chief for the Inquirer 3 decades back. Is he optimistic that the ability to access expenses online could help rein in spending?
Yeah, it's one of the points he made when we spoke with him as a veteran of looking at these records for several decades. And there have been lots of studies on this, both in and outside of Pennsylvania. But when spending records like this are public, there are studies that show that lawmakers are more and other officials are more careful about their spending. So, no matter what format this is posted in, and as we've discussed, there are some limitations to that. It is for the public good, and any constituent, but also investigators or reporters or auditors can look at this and make some assessments, and lawmakers might be a little more careful. Yeah.
At the same time, the Senate's effort seems to have gotten a so-so review from Eric Epstein of the good government group Rock the Capitol. What are his concerns, Sam?
Yeah, his concerns are similar to what we've been talking about. The format that these are posted in are not what a lot of people would say are ideal, considering what technology is available. And the legislature, for example, has another transparency website that has salary information on it and some other expenses and some benefits. And you can search for specific names and specific date ranges and compare over time. But with these expenses, and as we mentioned, they are kind of every other extraneous expense, you can't do that very easily, and you can't add them up, and you can't see how much your lawmaker is spending in total for the month that is posted, unless you can bring out your calculator. So,
okay. Sam, got to stop you there. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time. Sam Janish of the caucus, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Angela Columbus, reporter for Spotlight PA. It was a pleasure. Great to have you with us.
Thanks again.
Okay, we talk about the Philadelphia Fringe Festival up next on the Roundup. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It is almost impossible to suppress the irrepressible Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Though COVID tried its best, last year the iconic celebration of theater was primarily virtual, but this year's Fringe is a mix of online and live theatrical performance, underway now through early October in numerous locations around the Philly area. We've invited Fringe Arts President and Producing Director Nick Stuccio to join us for a look at some of the highlights of this year's event and what theatergoers might expect, staging, COVID requirements, and et cetera. Also, the Fringe Festival celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. Nick Stuccio, welcome. You are with us in studio. Great to have you with us. And happy 25th.
Thank you. So great to be here.
So way back then in the late 90s, did you expect the Fringe Festival would still be going strong a quarter century on?
I absolutely did not. I was a guy who needed a job. I was a dancer at Pennsylvania Ballet and now Philadelphia Ballet. And it was time for me to retire from that job and looking to do something. And I wanted to be a producer. I wanted to work with other artists. I met a lot of artists in Philadelphia. One, Eric Schoeffer, a local artist, wanted to go to Edinburgh, where there's this fantastic arts festival. He said, "Would you help me?" I was a novice producer. I said, sure, what the heck? I don't have anything else to do. And there we went. We spent a summer in Edinburgh, and while there, realized, wow, this could really work in Philadelphia, a big festival. And I started to understand the landscape back in Philly, that there was a ton of really interesting artists with not a vehicle for them to do their work. So we spent the summer there. We stole all the ideas we could, and we came back here, and we went door to door. The theater companies, the city. I just saw Erica Atwood, who was in a show years
really?
Ago. She was. She was the star of one of my favorite shows called 100% Philadelphia. But that's a subject for another day.
That's great trivia.
It worked well. It was really, we fell into a job that Philly really needed, which is to bring together this fantastic group of artists, an amazing group of artists, with a public, with this potential audiences that was looking for something cool and new and different.
So characterize the Fringe Festival experience for those who've never attended.
Wow, who has never attended the Fringe Festival? It's impossible.
There are a few of them out there.
In fact, let me just tell you a quick story about the Fringe Festival. I love this story. A few years ago, right before the pandemic, Fringe had opened. I was in a coffee shop in line. I chatted with somebody in line who's, you know, maybe 25-year-old woman. And I told her what I did. And she said, she started laughing. She said, you know, it's funny. Last night I heard outside my window, like at midnight, a fight, two people in a fight. My first thought was, that's probably just a Fringe show. and I realized, boy, then this thing has, you know, it has become the penetration of what we do is pretty broad. This, you know, this woman didn't know a time when there wasn't a Fringe Festival.
So how many different performances can we expect this year? You had a record number of applicants?
Yeah, there was a big pent-up demand of artists that wanted to make work, which is great, even through the pandemic. And boy, a lot of independent artists. So you know, during the pandemic, they were really decimated financially, you know, part of the gig economy. But they want to make work. They're compelled to make art. It's so great. It makes us so happy. We had about 200 artists, which is near record, that wanted to do shows. Fantastic.
Let's talk about some of the performances. We've got a clip right now from something called Sun and Sea, an opera in which, this is so cool, theater goers can look down on an actual beach, which was put together for this performance, with sunbathers doing what sunbathers do.
My head is dizzy. Lies an empty body. There's no water left in the bottle. My eyelids are heavy.
So, Nick Stuccio, who are the artists performing here?
This is great. This is an all-timer. Mary, you got to go see this. If you've not been to Fringe, this is a good sort of bridge show. This is a fantastic work. It won the Golden Lion at the Venice Biennale, the big prize, back in 2019. It's touring the world. It's touring the U.S. four cities. We're the second stop. It's in New York. It's opening tomorrow, Wednesday night. And it is this beautiful opera. I like opera. I'm not a huge opera fan, but I like opera. But this is fantastic. So all the singing you just heard, and those singers are in bathing suits. They're laying on beach towels, and they're playing with beach balls and dogs and kids, and singing this gorgeous opera.
While they're lying on beach towels.
Yes, while they're lying on beach towels and hanging out. And so the audience climbs up a big viewing platform, like 15 feet, and walks around it and just watches them. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful light, and it's just joyous and fantastic. Though, it's inspired by the global crisis of climate crisis. It's its inspiration. So there's that undertone to it. But it's but the cool thing about it is, and this is very Fringe, is the site. A lot of our work does not take place in theaters. And that's why I can tell you about a few other shows that do not take place in theaters. And that's fun. It's a fun adventure for audiences. And this certainly is that. We found a great old, giant old factory, a warehouse, beautiful warehouse in Nicetown. The old Bud factory where they made train cars. And we're bringing 30 tons of sand and we're making a beach. And by the way, this is together with Arcadia Exhibitions, Arcadia University. And we're going to put this beautiful show in this really cool old industrial warehouse. You got to go. Hey, by the way, it's 5 hours long. However, you buy a ticket for a certain time, a certain hour, and you can see the whole cycle. It's an hour cycle.
Another performance getting a lot of buzz is Baldwin and Buckley at Cambridge, staged by Elevator Repair Service. And this plays off the debate between James Baldwin and William F. Buckley in 1965 of a resolution called The American Dream is at the Expense of the American Negro. This is presented, Nick, verbatim, but at the same time, it's brought into the year 2021.
Correct.
At the moment.
Now, that show just closed. It was our opening
weekend.
Okay. Fantastic opening weekend. This was a really, and we were so thrilled to open the show, festival with it. It will play in New York. I think you must go find it. But yes, it was based on the transcript, the actual transcript of that debate in 1965 about race in America. And if you didn't know it was happening in 1965, that debate, you would think we're debating the exact same thing today.
Yeah. And another one we'd like to talk about is something called Air. Mariana Valencia is the artist, and apparently a nod to the generations of U.S. Mestiza and Latinx artists who exist in a hybrid of cultures. Let's take a listen.
He represents the people who don't always have running water. They don't always have electricity, yet they manage to see at night and go to work clean in the morning. They are the cleanest people you have ever seen, and the ones who work the hardest. They shine, and it's not the morning sunlight, and it's not the TV glow at night. They are simply shiny.
Yeah. Beautifully written vision.
Beautifully written. This is a fantastic artist, an artist that's really getting attention nationally, internationally, Mariana Valencia. And it's this weekend at the Drake Theater for a couple of shows. I would definitely recommend it. She is a deeply engaging and charming person, and really in a loving, a fun way, talks about all these cultures that she's steeped in and knows so deeply, and trying to figure out where they all belong in her life as a person, as an artist. And she does this beautiful monologue. It's dance. She dances and speaks, and it's terrific. You should miss that one.
We've got a question from Mindy. Due to COVID, can you please discuss some of Fringe Fest performances that will be outdoors?
Yes, I will say the best way to find out all of the various shows would be to go to our website, because there are a lot. There are over 200 shows. And there's descriptions, really detailed descriptions, and we categorize them in any number of ways, including outdoor performances. And so I won't list them all, but that's the best place to go, to our website, fringearts.com.
Producers aren't taking any chances with the Delta variant. Vaccination is required in large part, especially with the indoor performances, Nick.
That's right. Our policy. So we have two tranches of work that we curate, that we produce, the Fringe Festival produces, and then there's a big band of independently produced shows. The policy that we have established is that you must have a vaccine to enter the building. And that goes for audience, artists, staff, volunteers, everybody. And then while in a theater seat, you have to have a mask. And that policy is being adopted widely by the independent shows as well.
Yeah, and obviously there are virtual performances. I believe this one is virtual, a performance called Tree Confessions, which is an audio play billed as the world's first play told entirely from the point of view of a tree. And Nick, you simply find a tree and
absolutely. There are so many gems. And yeah. the fun part about The Fringe is to read the descriptions, and there are many, and they're fun, often fun descriptions, and to decide for yourself what sounds fun. The stakes are low. The shows aren't that long. They're pretty inexpensive, and it's the thing to try. I want to mention the Cannonball Festival.
Yes.
This is great. So this, we love.
Festival within a festival.
Exactly. Festival within a festival. It's very much like Edinburgh. I mentioned Edinburgh. This is very much how it works there, which is these hubs, these really big hubs. So Almanac Dance Circus Theater organized this and produced this. It's about 30 shows, loosely curated by Almanac, and it's at the Moz Building. And this is a really strong hub of really interesting artists that I would recommend going to see. And again, you can go to Cannonball Festival as its own website, or you can see it through Fringe Arts website as well.
So a fair number of Fringe Arts work is for audiences 18 and over, but there are performances that are, kid-friendly, I think The Ever-Present, presented by Theater Exile. Also, Dominique Ellis's Dance of the Lanternfly. I'm wondering if there's a lot of stomping in that performance, Nick.
You got me. I can't wait to see myself.
There's a lot of great stuff. So let's get back to some of the stuff I read about. You know, again, dealing with COVID. In early August, I read, before this was all getting underway, that you felt like you were sitting on a powder keg. And also, Nick, a lot of festival staff had been furloughed up until a few months ago. So what sort of logistical challenge did this pose to you in getting the festival together?
This was a hard one. That's exactly right. So 25 years we've been doing this. And the team at Fringe is astonishing. I've been doing this for 25 years. What a resilient bunch. And that's right. So we were, the budgets were completely blown up by COVID. We're still trying to recover. We did have a lot of furloughs. Normally, we have 12 months to put on a festival, and we had a runway of about four, if that, because the team, we were all not whole. And they did it. And opening night was a giant celebration. We had gorgeous weather, and boom, the shows happened. And it was a testament to the team at Fringe and the board and the volunteers. And it's a giant group of people that make this happen.
Can we expect to see performances which reflect the pandemic or the 20th anniversary of 9/11?
Well, Pig Iron just did their fantastic show. They did it for the fifth year anniversary of 9/11 called Love Unpunished. They just did it for the 20th year at the Prince, and it was fantastic. It was very beautiful and moving, and part of the same cast had done it back then 15 years ago. But as far as the pandemic, I will say, and that's good. I think that's a good thing.
Get away from it.
Yeah.
Escape.
Yeah. Yeah. Artists are making what they're interested in, And I think there's also a lag time. You know, this may show up in any subtle ways. I think you can look at things and look at the shows and see an echo effect of the year that artists spent in pandemic.
So in commemorating the 25th anniversary of Fringe, you are creating a virtual memory archive and are asking people who've attended over the years to reach out and share favorite memories. And you talked about, one of them a little bit earlier, the woman who, you know, thought a fight might be part of Fringe. Tell us about the archive and anything else you might have heard of this kind of interesting fight.
As the 25th year approached, we knew we better, let's do something for the 25th year. And so we began to collect stuff and think about stuff. And we realized that in 25 years, and boy, the list of shows is long. It's astonishingly long. We didn't record anything. We recorded like less than 1% of the show. So this festival and all of its history and memory only lives in people's hearts and minds. And so we went,
how do you feel about that?
I feel great. It's performance. Yeah. We have our colleagues that work in visual art where they work in art things, and we don't work in things. We work in ideas, and it happens, and it's poof, it's gone. I feel great about it. This is, you know, it's temporal. It's temporary. That's fantastic. It's contemporary art. But it does, as we found out, people have stories and amazing stories, and I love to hear them. We tried to collect them. We asked our public, please record them, please tell them. And I hear them all the time. I just talked to Erica on the way out about her show that she was in, I forget, 6-7 years ago. And she's got a great story about it. So that's where the Fringe lives. However, there is a bunch of stuff. There's memorabilia, there's T-shirts, and there's props and archives and toilet trikes and stuffed animals that were at various shows. And we've collected as much as we could. People sent a lot of stuff in. There's a thing called a ticket stub that my young staff is like, what's that? What is a ticket stub? And anyway, we have those, and we put them all together over at Cherry Street Pier, and you can go see all the great archive of times past.
If somebody wants to contribute a memory, where do they go?
Oh, our website. Or call me. Just email me. We'll record it. Our website. There's a way via our website.
So you told WHYY's Peter Crimmins it would be much harder to launch the Fringe Festival today than it was back in 1977. Why is that?
Well, 97.
I'm sorry, 1997.
Not that old. But, because if you, I don't know how far back you go, Mary, go. Yeah, mm-hmm. And Philly was a lot different place than it is today in the 90s. I mean, the scale of cosmopolitanism was about, as I said, about a minus 10. Today, it's off the charts. There was no food culture. You couldn't get a hamburger in this town at 9:30 at night. You just, you know, you couldn't get any food. But what an explosion of culture. Sure. Also, in terms of the contemporary art culture, visual arts and performance and music, there are so many amazing thinkers and makers and writers now. Back then, there were not. So it's a lot more crowded with fantastic things now. So it'd be a lot more difficult, I think. Back then, it was, as I said, we just sort of stumbled along, a bunch of passionate producers wanting to help artists, and they certainly needed the help. And today, there's still a lot of artists doing a lot of things, a lot of great producers.
Yeah. Ticket prices run the gamut?
Run the gamut. But people are coming out. They're buying tickets, doing it very safely. And I just want to mention two other shows.
Sure.
If I can. Because they're special. One is Not I. It's a Samuel Beckett piece. It's a 15-minute piece, and it's fantastic. It takes place in I mentioned one of those non-theater venues. This is it. It's an old kitchen from an old restaurant. It's intimate, and that's something not to miss.
Okay. All right. Well, and the fest. And you said, was there one more?
Well, Stellar. I want to mention Stellar Rise. Kyle Marshall.
Oh, right.
That's in 2 weeks at Fringe Arts. Another artist that's having a great national resurgence. Stellar Rise by Kyle Marshall. Please go see that too.
All right. And the festival runs through October 3rd.
Yes.
Nick Stuccio, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Nick Stuccio is Fringe Arts President and Producing Director. Our engineer today has been Al Banks, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. Mary Cummings Jordan, thank you so much for joining us, and be well.